This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And Patricia, in addition to the calls this hour, you could say we'll be sharing a one-in-a-million topic, eh? Well,
you could put it that way, indeed. You know, many of us have been lucky enough to have that. Oh, you know, that really special dog that just grabs your heart like my cool hand, Luke. And you know, a lot of people ask me to help them replace their one-in-a-million dog with another one-in-a-million dog. Well, we're going to talk today about why those special one-in-a-million dogs are...
One in a million.
hard to find because they're one in a million.
Okay. And we're all aware of the controversies surrounding dog breeds like the pit bull. But today we welcome a guest who says the situations we face with pit bulls are no different from those we faced a century ago with bloodhounds, German shepherds, and even Newfoundlands. Later this hour, find out what we can learn from the past when it comes to dealing with stereotypes about different dog breeds. Meanwhile, let's take some calls. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm from Virginia Beach. And we have a wonderful feral cat that we adopted in July from a very fine resort community up in northern Ohio. And this cat just loves playing around the house and works real nice with our other cat. But we find it's really difficult to pat her and to really get close to her. She lets us pat her sometimes, often at night and when she's sleeping a little bit. But often just won't let us get very close to her, even though she'll be nearby and in the area sometimes with us. Just wondered if you can give us some help and getting her over this. It just seems like it's a knee-jerk reaction with her to kind of not allow us to get too close to her once we're within a few feet.
Sounds like one of my former cats.
Really?
Yeah.
Was your stray cat that you adopted a bit like that?
Yeah, a little bit like
Hunter?
That. Yeah, Hunter. Yeah. Hunter was like that a lot.
And you know, that's quite common, especially with feral cats who spend a lot of time outside in the wild. And you know, there's some interesting research about that. It was actually done in Great Britain, oh, maybe 20 years ago, and they looked at shyness, which is really what we're talking about, you know, shyness, afraid of sort of social contact in cats. And they found that there was a very strong genetic component and a very strong environmental component, and that early socialization with kittens happens between 3 and 7 weeks of age.
Really early.
Yeah. And what they found was, is if you bred a really shy male who tended to have shy kittens and then didn't socialize them very much, you end up with, not surprisingly, super, super shy kittens. And so it's sort of an integration of both genetics and environment. And there's some suggestions that cats that make it as feral cats, there's a selection for shyness in feral cats because it's those cats that are clever enough to hide and, you know, avoid danger by being really flighty who are more successful at reproducing in the wild. So the first thing I have to say about sort of what to do about it is I want you to sit down and think about, who is this a problem for? Is it a problem for the cat, which it probably isn't, or is it a problem for you? You know, and I don't know about the listener, but I love to cuddle with cats.
Me too.
Having a cat sleep on my chest at night. Are you the same way?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's exactly true. And I think, by and large, it is a problem for the caller here because she's very happy in the house and plays and enjoys herself a lot. And we actually got her as a kitten, so she was probably about 6 weeks old.
Okay.
And so it does make sense about the genetic component that you're describing. That really makes a lot of sense.
It does, yeah.
But you're exactly right. It's a problem. It's our problem. It's much more than her problem. She's having a great time.
But, you know, I mean, I share that problem. I did the same. I got a cat from a humane society who didn't really want to be touched either. And you might want to try a couple of things. One is I basically never went towards her. I never reached my hand towards her. I never pursued her. I never picked her up and sort of forced her into petting. What I did do, though, is I had lots of little tiny wonderful food treats that I knew she loved. And also I did the same thing before I put her dinner bowl down. is I would just stand still with food and let her come to me. And then what I started doing is she would circle around in front of me. And as she approached me, I would drop a treat right in front of her on the ground. And then over time, I only dropped that food when she got a little closer and a little closer. And by week three, I only dropped the food if she actually touched against me, even for a microsecond. So basically, I developed a cat who, in order to get the food dispenser to work, to get the Pez dispenser, you know, to flick out a treat, she had to touch me. And so keep it up. And good for you for adopting her.
Thanks.
Bless your heart.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to join in. Patricia, do you remember a few weeks ago when we talked to Maureen in Middleburg, Virginia, whose horse was afraid of cattle? Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cynthia in Millwood, Virginia, sent us a pet tip to tell us that she's had innumerable cow-phobic horses over the years.
No kidding.
Yeah, and she has a trick that works every time for her. She writes that the trick is to borrow a known non-phobic horse that Maureen's horse is compatible with, then put the two of them out with a herd of beef cows, a mixed herd of Angus, etc., anything but dairy cows, then turn and walk away. And by morning, the two horses will be grazing happily alongside the bovines. Cynthia says the next step in the process is to be sure that the rider is not tensing at the sight of cows. There's no better way to make a horse nervous than to lose your own nerve. So look away and kick on. What do you think?
That is just wonderful. Could I send Cynthia a box of chocolate or a bale of hay or something? That's great advice. You know, that's called social facilitation. I've done it with dogs where a dog was afraid of people, and basically you let another dog who loves people come up. They get the treats. They get the ball. You know, they get petting, and the other dog is like, oh, well, maybe, you know,
maybe
this isn't so bad.
Thing.
That's brilliant, and I should have thought of it before, but I love. But thank you, Cynthia. I love that advice. And the point about not tensing up, this is relevant to everybody with any species who has a situation in which you've learned there might be trouble. It's very, you have to consciously fight that. And so not only looking away, but also consciously keep your body loose and breathe. Because what we tend to do when we stop, when we get a little nervous, is we stop breathing, and your horse can sense that in a microsecond. Great advice.
And how does someone else send us a pet tip?
Oh, please keep sending us such great ideas. It's really easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And again, if you want to join in with a question by phone, here's that number. It's 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Angie from Fort Monroe, Virginia.
Hi, Angie. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, the problem that I have is I have a 4-year-old long-haired tortoiseshell cat who has a very unique problem. She, I guess the best way we can describe this is she has a nervous eating problem. Anytime any stress is introduced into her life, she will immediately turn and run to her food bowl and start eating.
This sounds like me.
Yeah, me.
You're describing me.
It's kind of funny to watch, and at the same time, she's gaining a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And we've also noticed that whenever my husband or I walk towards her food bowl, which is right by our kitchen, she will run to her food bowl and stand over it in a very protective manner. She's never had her food taken away, and we're just wondering, what psychologically is motivating this cat to behave this way?
Hmm. Or physically?
Oh, physically,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, both. And, you know, those are very often integrated, right? First thing I want to say is, oh, those torties. Torties are famous for having behavioral challenges. Ask any veterinarian or cat breeder or behaviorist. So the big question here, I think, is, why is your cat so anxious? You know, why does your cat need to run to the food to soothe herself? I mean, a lot of individuals, although much more people than animals, you don't see this that commonly in dogs and cats, frankly, is really common in people to be an emotional eater and to eat when you're a little nervous, or like me, to eat when you're happy or sad or, you know,
lonely,
I don't know, you, yeah, or not, or, you know, pretty well name it. But do you have any idea why this cat is anxious so much?
She really is a pretty even-keeled cat, except for this one little quirk. We've noticed that a trigger that sets her off is if she starts scratching on a piece of furniture, which she doesn't do often, and we clap our hands and say, no, that's a big trigger for her. She'll then run to her food bowl. She really doesn't, we have another cat. That's not really a stressor for her. And they lead a pretty good life. So yeah. I can't think of anything right offhand.
Lucky girl. How often does this happen that she runs to her food bowl and eats sort of compulsively?
About one or two times a day.
Okay. Well,
that's quite a bit.
Yeah, this seems to be quite a bit. I mean, there are a couple things you can think of doing. One is teaching her a different coping mechanism. So, for example, you figure out what some of her easy stressors are. Clapping is a perfect example because you can replicate it. And you can replicate it at a very low intensity. So you can go clap, clap relatively softly, but you're prepared. You're not going to just clap out of the blue. You're going to be ready. You're going to be ready with her favorite toy or her favorite treat, and which one depends on her. You're going to go clap, clap quietly, and then direct her to do something else besides go eat. So that would be the ideal thing to do, and then gradually over time, you can make your claps louder and louder. If there are a set amount of predictable triggers that you can do that with, like three or four different triggers, then often it will generalize to all the rest of them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's for right now, that's what I would try. If it gets more, if it starts increasing, it might be time to talk with your vet about obsessive compulsive disorder, but I don't think you should go there yet.
Okay. Now,
try this first. Thank you very much for calling.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
All right. Appreciate your call.
Good luck.
Good luck. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll find out why one in a million dogs are, well, one in a million. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And Tricia, many of our listeners can relate when you talk about your one-in-a-million dog, Cool Hand Luke. And, of course, you know how hard it is when we finally have to say goodbye to our special friend like that.
Oh, man, that's the truth. You know, I wrote at one point that I imagined Luke's death to be like trying to live when someone had taken the oxygen out of the air.
Yeah.
and that's how it felt, you know? And I've had a lot of people who've had dogs like that. And Larry, I've had several clients, especially lately, who came to me asking me to help them replace their one in a million dogs. You know, these were amazing dogs that they used in therapy sessions, psychologists, people who had these wonderful dogs who were like 100% bomb-proof, you know, even the therapy dogs, some of them around people who had really serious behavioral problems, and they want me to help them replace them. But, you know, that's a hard thing to do.
Well, you'd think that we'd all know that by definition, one in a million dogs don't come around very often.
Well, you know, it makes sense when we say it that way, it sort of sounds obvious. But, you know, once you've had one, it is so seductive to try and find another.
Yeah.
And I'm, as you know, I'm the first one to say that we need to do everything we can do to find the right dog, you know, to be thoughtful about finding the right dog for you and your family. But it's so easy and yet unfair to expect that next dog to fill the shoes of the last one.
And it seems in general we expect a lot from our dogs nowadays.
Oh, man, don't we? You know, we really do. I mean, we expect them to be great with visitors, to tolerate children who sometimes, let's face it, you know, can be close to abusive to dogs.
Yes.
We expect them to be clean inside and to be, you know, nice outside the house and all that with not a lot of training, you know?
Yeah.
It used to be we expected dogs to, I don't know, not bite the kids, if even that, you know. I love that we have high expectations of dogs because we, as you use better training methods, it's reasonable to expect a lot of our dog. But there's just so much we can ask, and every single dog is different. You know, every dog has his own strengths. Every dog has his own weaknesses.
And you've had Will for about a year now, and you've talked about him on the show. He doesn't sound anything like Luke.
He's not. You know, Luke was my soulmate, one in a million border collie. Will is his nephew. And he's now a year and a half old border collie. And while Luke was, oh my goodness, he was bomb-proof around people. I used him on dog-dog aggression cases for years. He was amazing with other dogs. I took him everywhere. He was polite and handsome and flirted with women. I mean, everybody adored this dog. And I adored him and he adored me. I got his nephew, Will, who I also adore now. But I got to tell you, he came with projectile diarrhea for 3 months. He was pathologically afraid of unfamiliar dogs, even at 7 weeks of age, with no explanation for why that would be true. He hurt his shoulder and had to be crate, quote, rested. What a nightmare. For 2 months is a 9 week. He's had a raft of problems. He's not Luke. But
he's one in a million in his own way.
He's one in a million. He's one in a million in his own way. But you know what? He's not going to be Luke. But it's okay because he is who he is, and I love him. And it's really I have to remind myself that if you call him one in a million, then you're not going to get him very often.
And that's a very important thing to keep in mind. And by the way, we want to hear about your one in a million dog. Share your dog story with us. Send us an email through our website. It's callingallpets.org. And, you know, we're going to post some of those stories and photographs on our website. That'd be a lot of fun.
I can't wait to read some of these stories.
I can't wait as well. And if you can't wait to talk to us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Michael from Great Falls, Virginia.
Hi, Michael. Thanks a lot for calling.
Sure. I have a 14-month-old golden retriever who has never barked. And I'm not sure if that's a problem, but it's definitely something my wife and I are very curious about. We have a 5-year-old golden who is a very good watchdog, but the 14-month-old has not made a peep.
You know, James Herriot wrote a children's book called something like Just One Woof, or Only One Woof, about a dog who barked once in his life. Woof. And I had a border collie, Pippi Tay. Pip barked once in her life, and she went, woof. She died 1 month shy of 16 years of age. So it's possible that your golden also will be in that sort of two standard deviations outside of the normal bell curve.
I see.
And it's possible that your golden won't bark. But keep in mind that there's a developmental process that goes on, that barking is something that often doesn't develop until a dog gets older. And goldens are notorious for being sort of late bloomers, for staying puppy-like, you know, until they're 08. You
know? I see.
So it's possible that as your golden gets older, he or she will bark. I've also, by the way, seen, and I have no idea if this might be relevant, but in some cases, I've seen dogs who didn't bark very much when the other dog in the household did, which is the reverse of what's usual. What's typical is that barking is contagious. One dog barks, the other dogs bark, and
that's
then everybody's barking. Yeah, that's and you're right to expect that. That's what's most common. But I've also seen the reverse, where there were two or three dogs. One dog's the designated barker. And then when that dog dies or goes away, the other dog's like, oh, well, now I have to be. You know, I have to be the barker. So there's a possibility that that's going on. My guess is it's more partly personality, partly genetically mediated personality, is that you have a dog who's just not particularly vocal.
Interesting.
And it might be that the barking comes on as the dog ages, and it might not.
Might not. Like Pippi Tay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, call us back in a while and let us know. I'd love to follow this case. Call us back. Let us know how it's going.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Janice in Norfolk, Virginia.
Janice, hi. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have an interesting situation. My husband and I were rescued by a Cocker Spaniel 3.5 years ago, and we did not realize at the time that he was almost completely deaf, and he is now completely deaf.
Aww.
He's probably about 5 years old, and he is a wonderful pet, except that it's difficult to train him unless I can make eye contact
with
him.
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when he barks and I can't see him face-to-face, I have no way of encouraging him to stop that. And the other issue I worry about is that we have a 9-month-old grandson, and the dog is Sonny, and Sonny doesn't hear Colin sneaking up on him.
Mm.
So I'm looking for tips to train a deaf dog. He responds very well to hand signs, if I can make eye contact with
him. Right, right. And one of the good things about working with a dog who can't hear very well or who is completely deaf is that dogs respond to visual signals actually better than acoustic ones anyway.
Oh, that's
so, yeah, so yeah. Once you, again, challenges to mm-hmm. get his
attention.
Get that eye contact. But once you get it, you can train him to do anything and actually can train it faster.
He's very smart. There's no question about that.
Good.
Is there anything that he could possibly hear that I'm not aware of?
Well, probably no, but there are two things you can use that people use with deaf children, as a matter of fact, is one, you can use light. So, for example, say he goes outside at night to go potty
mm-hmm.
And you want to call him to come back in. Have yard lights that you can flick off and on.
Okay.
So your comm signal is flick, flick, you know, like the theater, you know, when
wonderful.
The lights flick back and forth. That's the best thing you can use is some kind of visual signal that pervades the entire environment and is not restricted to him having to look at you to see it. So that's your best cue.
But on a sunny day and...
Yeah, on a sunny day, that can be a problem. The other thing you can try, but you have to be relatively close, are pressure waves through the ground. So, for example, if he's not too far away from you, say he's 10 feet away from you barking out the window. If you stomp your foot... depending on the substrate, and I'm not an expert in the physics.
We're
not engineers here, but I know that with the deaf dogs that I've worked with, if you're relatively close on certain substrates, you can make contact with them by sending a pressure wave through the ground.
Okay.
And see if you get any kind of response whatsoever.
Well, I really appreciate that. He's a wonderful pet, and I've had people get angry with me on the street when I'm walking because he barks so much, and yet if I can see him eye to eye, he'll stop, but not when he's got his back to me.
Yeah. Barking is a big problem with deaf dogs because they can't even hear themselves.
Right.
And so they don't, like children, they don't self-regulate their vocalizations.
Right.
So, yeah, so try those tips.
Well, thank you.
Yep.
I really appreciate it.
Janice, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here's the number for you to join in. It's 1-800-462-7413. Patricia, we had an email from Jackie in Northport, Florida. She wrote us with a question about her granddaughter, as a matter of fact. Here's what she writes. My granddaughter just turned 5 years old, and she's already afraid of dogs. Doesn't matter what breed or size the dog is. She's simply afraid of them, despite having no known incidences with dogs in the past. We are currently petless, except for an angelfish, and I'd like to get a dog again. But first, I'd like to know, how do you help a child learn to love a dog or not be afraid of a dog?
Well, there are some tried and true methods of changing emotional reactions to different kinds of stimuli that are actually very similar no matter what the species is. So some of the things that I do with dogs, desensitization, classical counter conditioning are the same things that psychologists actually do with children. So if this is severe, I would definitely recommend that you talk to a psychologist who specializes in fears and phobias and using humane and effective methods. The basics of it is you create a situation in which, in this case, dogs, for example, are presented in the least possible threatening way. For example, you would get pictures of dogs, mm-hmm. and you would just have a picture of a dog sitting up in your living room somewhere. And you wouldn't make a big deal about it. You wouldn't force the child to go over to it. One of the most important things to keep in mind is to eliminate what we like to think of as encouragement and what the child thinks of as forcing.
Bullying.
Bullying, yeah, out of your repertoire. So don't say, come on, honey, go look at the picture. It's just a picture. It's okay. Don't hand her the picture and make her hold it. Just let it hang out there for a while. Maybe put a little bowl of candy beside it or something like that. So, you know, first she gets used to pictures of dogs, and then perhaps she gets used to seeing dogs a very, very, very long way away, where she's absolutely sure the dogs can't get anywhere near her. She might see other kids interacting with dogs, talking about social facilitation sometimes can mm-hmm. be useful. So that's the desensitizing part, is you gradually expose her to dogness in a completely non-threatening way, step by step.
Maybe a video? Would video?
Maybe a video. Yeah, good idea, Larry. Maybe
movie or something?
Video, movies. So that's one way to do it. The classical counter conditioning is actually trying to counter the emotion she has with a different emotion. So you would say dog and give her a piece of chocolate or something like that. Show a picture, you know, and have something good happen with it. But most importantly, don't force anything and don't go fast.
And that's great advice. And if someone else has a question for us, what do they do?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. You know, one easy way to do it is just to go to our website. Go to callingallpets.org and get a hold of us through that.
And if you'd like to talk to us in person, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, discover why breeds like the Newfoundland were once considered the most dangerous dogs around. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Karen DeLeese to the program. Karen is the author of the book, The Pit Bull Placebo, The Media, Myths, and Politics of Canine Aggression, and she joins us today to talk about it. Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Your book focuses on stereotypes that people have had about different breeds of dogs throughout the ages. Some might be surprised to learn that the Newfoundland was once considered a dangerous breed. And you write about how Newfies were used by fishermen to aid drowning victims. What happened to tarnish the Newfie's image?
Back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the Newfoundland appeared to be a very popular breed in the United States. And they were sought out for many functions, but they seemed to be sought out a lot for protection work, guard work, as guard dogs. And I think that the use in this negative function helped perpetuate this image of fierceness. And, of course, when a dog is used in a negative function like guard dog use, aggression is encouraged. And so this, I really believe this helped perpetuate the image that Newfoundlands were dangerous.
So even though they aided drowning victims and did good things like that, the negative kinds of things that they had sort of overcame those good things.
Right, and there was quite a balance. I mean, I think that they started off with a very positive image, and then as it became increasingly popular, and their loyalty was a reason why they were obtained a lot of times and used as guard dogs, because they were so loyal to their masters. And, of course, the size, I'm sure, had a lot to do with it. They're large dogs. And so I think that the positive image came first, and then the negative image came afterwards when they became so popular and used in so many negative functions.
You know, there was another breed you write about in your book that got a lot of negative attention in the 19th century, and that's the bloodhound. What were bloodhounds, first of all, to 19th century Americans?
Well, unfortunately for the bloodhound, in the United States, they were used mostly in a negative function. And I think they first came into the Americans' consciousness with the production of many of the Uncle Tom stage productions. And they used them as in a dramatic scene, as entertainment, and that's when they were chasing the escaped slave Eliza across the Ohio River. Reality was confused with myth, and the myth was to make these dogs look even more ferocious for the sake of entertainment. And then they became very popular in the late 1880s, 1890s, they became very popular as guard dogs.
I'm wondering how a dog then, like the bloodhound or the Newfie, who were considered then very dangerous dogs, how does that turn around? Because I don't think, if you think about bloodhounds today, most people think about bloodhounds or Newfies in a very positive way.
Well, there can be no denying breed fads. We've all seen it in our own lifetimes, how breeds become more popular. And each generation, you know, as human beings, we get bored with the same old, same old. So after a few decades, you know, people got bored with the whole negative image of the bloodhounds and the Newfies, and then they moved on to the Shepherds and the Dobermans, and it's just, it's cyclic. It's one breed after the other.
You say on the one hand that things are a little different and that our perceptions are that this has never happened before, and yet there's this continuity of sort of the bad dog du jour kind of issue. Does that mean that based on what, on all the research you did and media reports over the last 200 or so years, that it looks as though the frequency of dog bites is relatively similar, or is it higher now? What perspective do you get on that?
Well, we always have to remember that there are more dogs and more humans than there ever were. So in that respect, you're going to have more dog bites simply because there are more dogs and there are more humans. Back in the 1950s, it was estimated there were about 30 million dogs. Or 25 to 30 million. Well, today there's estimated there's 65 to 70 million dogs. But if you were to actually look at the numbers of bites reported and the number of fatal attacks, they are consistent. They're not increasing any more to the population of dogs or the population of humans. And if anything, there seems to be less reported dog bites, because there's greater enforcement of leash laws. There are more responsible owners today than there ever were. So in New York City back in 1970, they had over 35,000 dog bites reported per year, while today dog bites in New York City are about 6,000 per year. So we actually have less dog bites, but that's due to factors that don't relate to breed. It has to do with enforcement of laws and humane treatment towards dogs. So actually, dogs, if you look at it that way, are less dangerous today than they were 100 years ago.
Has your research about reports of dog attacks and dog bites over all of these years, in all these accounts, newspaper and magazine accounts that you looked at, has that given you any ideas about what we should do about the problem that we have now? I mean, the fact of the matter is that shelters all over the country have huge number of what are called the bull breeds, of pit bull type dogs, of the bully breeds. Has the past informed any thoughts about what we should do about it? How do we get ourselves out of the situation we're in now?
You know, I think we have to admit that there's always a segment of the population that doesn't view dogs the same way that another segment of the population views dogs. And we always have to understand that dogs are disposable in our society. And this has always been the problem with them. They're easy to obtain, they're easy to get rid of, and because of that, they don't have as much value as they should. And I don't know what we can do about that as far as educating people and having people in their hearts and minds treat dogs more humanely. I really don't know the answer to that. I wish I did. But you're right. I mean, the shelters are full of dogs, and they're full of the dogs that people seek out for image enhancing or as status symbols. And they're seeking them out for other reasons than to be companion animals. So they're easily disposed of when they're no longer useful for whatever the purpose was that they were acquired for.
Well, one way to help is to write a book, something like The Pit Bull Placebo, to give people the background that they need to really understand the context. And Karen, I thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Karen DeLeese is the author of The Pit Bull Placebo, The Media, Myths, and Politics of Canine Aggression. She joined us today from her home office in Slainsville, West Virginia. 1-800-462-7413 is the number where you can reach us if you have a question about your animal's behavior. And someone's waiting for us right now, as a matter of fact. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Adam Jackson from Oklahoma City, and I've got a question about my dog, Bugsy.
Bugsy.
I have two dogs, and a mother and daughter. And the younger one, I cannot get this dog to potty train. I mean, after 5 years, she still will just refuse to go outside. I'll take them both out at the same time. Mom will go to the bathroom every time, just right on cue, and the other one will just stand there and look at her like she's crazy, and then run back inside, and then eventually she'll need to go, and she'll find a spot on the carpet, and it just drives me crazy.
And 5 years of that is a problem,
you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
You have a lot of patience.
I set my expectations a little low.
I think you're wonderful.
You have a lot of patience, Adam.
You get the prince of the year.
It's not a daily thing. If it were a daily event, it would be, she would just be an outside dog. But it's, once every 2 or 3 weeks or something like that, she'll do it.
Okay.
But it's often enough that it just drives me up the wall.
Yeah, I don't blame you. What kind of dogs?
They're rat terriers.
Okay. And the reason I ask is because size matters.
Okay.
Size matters when you're talking about bathroom behavior in dogs. Is the smaller they are, the harder they are to house train. There's no way around it. It's just true. But so here's some things I would do. First of all, whenever you have a problem like this, it can have many, many reasons for it. She might be, maybe it's cold outside or it's wet. So you might want to look to see if there's any kind of a discernible pattern. A lot of rat terriers, for example, I don't want to go when it's wet. I don't like it when it's wet outside.
And this is an odd dog anyways.
Is she?
Because when she's inside, she runs to the nearest corner and just cowers with her ears back and her tail tucked like we beat her to death all the time.
Yeah.
And then the minute she gets outside, she hits that backyard and the ears are up and the tail's up and she's running around barking as happy as she can be.
Oh.
So it's like, why didn't she want to potty outside? She likes to be outside.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
She's a little bit of an odd duck anyways.
You know, one of the most common explanation for what you're describing are dogs who started as puppies to potty in the house, and the well-meaning owner said no. And what the dog learned was not don't potty in the house. What the dog learned is don't potty in front of your owner. So we take them outside, we stand there, we say go potty, and they're like, hey, I learned my lesson. How stupid am I? What, are you setting me up or something here? So I don't know if that's what happened or not. But here's what I do. I would go outside as if she was a seven-week-old puppy. I would go outside with the best treats in the world. And at first what she's going to do is dance around your feet going like, I smell turkey. So you're gonna stand there and think like, oh, this is a stupid idea. But just look away from her. Cross your arms, look up, look away. It's like, nope. And what I want you to do is every time she's about to go to the bathroom, and you know the signs, is I want you to say, hurry up, or go pee, or whatever, put it on cue. And then you're right beside her when she goes, and then you give her a treat just as she gets up.
Okay.
And you're going to do that a lot. Do that week after week after week, and then gradually start giving her a treat only part of the time. Always say, good girl, so you always have that praise reinforcement going on. And then if you take her outside and she doesn't go outside, and you know she's going to have to go, take her out again in 10 minutes. And if she goes that time, then it's like jackpot. She gets 5 treats in a row. Oh, what a good girl. Oh, you're so clever. So try.
How do you know I talk to him that way?
Because you're so sweet. I can tell. So try that, and we'll cross our paws for you.
Thanks, Adam.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Hey, I love the show.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-462-7413. And don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of The Pit Bull Placebo by Karen DeLeese. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, want to take a stab at it, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of The Pit Bull Placebo by Karen DeLeese. And here's today's question. The bloodhound traces its roots to ancient times. Their earliest ancestors may have been the black St. Hubert's hound, documented in Europe around the 8th century. William the Conqueror is credited with introducing the breed to England in the year 1066. In what century was the bloodhound introduced to the United States? If you think you know the answer, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413 and find out if you're correct by visiting callingallpets.org. We'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And, Tricia, let's return to the 21st century. Start taking some more calls. Should we do that?
I think that's a great idea.
I think so, too. Here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Flory, and I'm in Eureka, California.
Well, thanks very much for calling, Flory. What can we do for you?
Well, I've got an interesting situation here. I have a cat. His name is Junior. He's a male tuxedo kitty, and he keeps running away back to our old house. But it wasn't right after we had moved to a new place. It was 1 year after we had moved from a country setting to the more city-like setting of Eureka. And I picked him up thinking, oh, maybe he got lost. I brought him home, and sure enough, he turned around and did it again. And it turned out he did it three times. He ran away in the fall of 2006, and I don't know why he decided to stay at Eureka. I thought he would be home for good, but then again, in 2007, he ran away three more times to our old place in Freshwater. Every time he showed up right to my old house, my old landlord would call me up and say, Flory, your cat's here again.
Dear. Oh, boy.
I was wondering if you had any answers for me.
Yeah, it's such a good set of questions. And the first thing I would say is this has nothing to do with how much he loves you. You know, this has nothing to do with that. But I'm really interested in the pattern that you've told us about, fall. This is happening every fall. And there, I see a lot of behaviors that change seasonally. Light changing, air changes, the scents are changing. And so specifically, what is the trigger? I don't know. But I can tell you there are a lot of animals who tend to change their behavior and maybe want to start. One of the behaviors that changes is roaming. So we don't know what force you're fighting, but it's probably stronger than tuna.
Probably.
So have you thought about finding a way to let your cat be outside but keep him enclosed in some way, some kind of a cat yard?
I have thought about that, but the only way I think I'd be able to do that is if I enclosed my yard with some sort of screen over our fence, because our yard is already fenced in with like an 8 foot tall wooden fence.
Okay, but he can jump.
Oh, yeah, he climbs right over that. He's a very wild kitty.
Well, the one thing I can tell you about fences, there are two things. One is if there are a lot of trees up against the fence, then that's obviously...
You're sunk.
Yeah, I got no solution. But if not, what you can do with an 8 foot fence is to put a addition to it that leans inward. And it doesn't have to be very huge. If it's only about 2 feet or so, it's almost impossible for an animal to, you know, when he jumps up, he's going to sort of hit a ceiling that's leaning diagonally in towards the yard.
Right.
And it's really hard for them to get around and over that. So if you don't have a lot of trees next to the fence, that might be a good solution.
I'll definitely give it some thought, but I think he still might go crazy. He's a very outdoor-oriented cat.
His strong feelings.
Well, you know what? When the fall of the year comes, I want to get out, roam around. Sometimes I'll drive. Sometimes I'll get out and walk the marshes and fields.
And Larry's,
it's that time of the year.
Larry's wife has built this special fence. No, I'm just kidding.
She's got this chain and a leash that she puts on. No.
Renee will never forgive us.
Thanks a lot for calling, Flory. Appreciate it very much. Tricia, we received an email question from a listener named Donna that I thought you'd be interested in. She says her 10-year-old cat has rarely traveled in the car except for brief visits to the vet. She howls very loudly on these trips and also defecates in her carrier.
Ooh.
Yeah, for the first time, Donna would like to take her cat on a longer 2-hour drive and have her stay with Donna at a friend's house for a couple of weeks. How can Donna get her cat to be comfortable for this 2-hour drive? And how can she acclimate the cat to her friend's house And by the way, Donna's friend does not have any pets.
Can you spell drugs? And this is obviously,
that's what I do.
This is obviously something you need to talk to your veterinarian about. But if the cat defecates in the crate, I mean, that's telling us this cat isn't anxious. This cat's terrified. So could you possibly condition this cat to become more and more comfortable in a carrier in a car? Yeah, you could if you have a lot of time. It's possible. You could set the carrier out in the house, just take the door off, leave it open, spray it with Feel Away, that spray pheromone that often calms some cats. Get the cat so that it's the carrier has become a great sleeping place. Put food in there. Maybe put a little safe heating pad. Be sure that the heating pad is safe. Always need to be conscious of electricity and that possible danger. But you can get the cat more comfortable with the carrier. Then you can put the carrier in the car. Don't even turn the car on. Get the cat comfortable being in the carrier in the car without the car even moving. So you gradually go step by step. But this is not a process you can rush. So if you're
the
leaving,
quick way.
If you're, the quick way is to call your veterinary clinic. Your veterinarian knows your cat's health history. There are a lot of medications that either dampen anxiety. Some of them make the cat a little sleepy, and that might be just fine. Then when you get to the new home, I would definitely, one, use that spray pheromone or the plug-in atomizer, Feel Away. Definitely want to keep the cat in a small space. Don't let the cat wander all over the house. That actually can be very intimidating to cats. They're more comfortable in a new place, being in one small room, cat box on one side, food and water on the other. Maybe the bedroom where you're going to sleep would be ideal. And then gradually let the cat adjust at her own pace, and then gradually open the door, let her wander around.
Good advice. And if someone else has a question for us, how do they reach us?
Oh, we love it when you ask questions or give us ideas. Maybe somebody else has an idea for our listener. And just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And go to our website, take a look there and find our email there and find a whole lot of other information as well. And if you want to talk to us, the number is 1-800-462-7413. Someone wants to do that. So let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Julie from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Hi, Julie. Thanks a lot for calling.
Glad you guys took my call. I've been trying to get you guys for quite a while because you seem to be the experts on all the pets.
Well, good for you for having stamina. we'll reinforce you for stamina. Good girl.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a currently have a mini schnauzer that I just love to pieces, but she's getting really old, and I'm looking towards the days that I'm going to be having to get another dog. But I've just gotten so spoiled with her that I'm kind of think I'm almost being a little bit too picky about the next kind of breed that I want. I want to switch from a mini schnauzer, but I like the fact that they're a non-shedding breed. They're pretty smart from the schnauzers that I've met.
Oh, yeah.
Not really that much of a barker. Not like a, you know, arf, like all the time would probably put me over the edge.
So maybe we should eliminate Beagle.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the Beagles. I love Beagles. And they're not all barky. You know, they don't all read those books.
Yeah.
You know, now miniature schnauzers have a reputation of being a little vocal as well. Is that why you don't want my first question when you started talking was why don't you want a miniature schnauzer?
Although I love her so much, the skin issue has just been so But I love Beagles, too, but, man, they can bark.
They can be a little talky. Well, just a quick note about schnauzers before we talk about some other breeds is that the skin condition, you know, the breed that's famous for skin problems are golden retrievers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So if that's the main problem, then, you know, I would just go look for a miniature schnauzer and just absolutely go way out of your way to find a line that has just never had that problem reported in it. So that's something you might want to think about because it sounds like there are a lot of things about the schnauzer that you really liked. So that's not necessarily a breed-related trait. It's more related to an individual or a line. But there are lots of other small dogs under 30 pounds who are friendly and who are smart. The non-shedding is the trickier part. Now, keep in mind that even short-haired dogs can shed a lot, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs that tend to be the best non-shedders are the ones that have been bred to have that are fuzzy, that don't have guard hairs. It's the guard hairs that tend to cause most of the sort of shedding problems.
Poodle types?
Yeah, Bichon Frise. I gotta tell you, I love little poodles. I love little poodles. They are so smart and so friendly. Are they going to be yappy? Completely depends on the line, the individual, and you.
Now, what do you guys feel about mixed breeds? Because I've heard that sometimes if you get a mixed breed, that maybe it, you know, the dominant health trait that may be a problem would be kind of like dampened by the other breed. Is that true?
Well, hybrid vigor is a well-established genetic phenomena, and indeed it's true that there are some breeds that are so inbred that you end up with these
health problems,
traits that, yep, that are not dominant, and but they're recessive, but you end up doubling up, and so you end up with some more health problems too. But that's certainly – that I absolutely would not – throw that out of the mix. Certainly a possibility. Cockapoo, you know, that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. Teddy bear, another possibility.
A what bear?
Teddy bear. Go look up teddy bears.
Pretty
cute. Pretty cute. Pretty cute. Good luck, Julie.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Patricia, thank you. Hey, it was fun.
Oh, it was.
We had a great time
today.
You're
a teddy bear yourself, Larry.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist, teddy bear, and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0119P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.